VinePair's New York City headquarters, I'm Adam Teeter.
And in Seattle, Washington, I'm Zach Jabal.
And this is the Monday VinePair podcast. Zach, let's get right the fuck into it with an F-bomb and a what the fuck have you been drinking?
Oh, man, it's a Monday with just you and me.
Yeah.
You know, so as I think will be a topic of conversation throughout the episode, I was on the road this past week, as you were too. I was in Boise, Idaho for a kind of opportunity to explore two aspects of the scene there, the wine scene in the nearby Snake River Valley. So did some wine tasting, tried, wines from 8 or 9 different wineries over the course of my time there. You know, some interesting wines, some interesting Riesling, in particular from a winery called Scoria. Had some couple of good Syrahs. It's been interesting to see. There's, lots to take away from the wine scene. But for the sake of the podcast, I'm mostly going to focus on cocktails because there were some kick-ass cocktail bars in Boise. I would say highlights for me included, I had some great cocktails at a place called The Lively. They had a fun nice. Riff on a Negroni called the Jabroni, which appealed to me not just because it started with the first 3 letters of my last name, but also just a nice take on it. Also had a fun version of, what else did we have there? I had a kind of a mezcal cocktail called ChatGPT that was quite good, smoky, but also had a nice kind of fruity note underneath it. And then other couple bars, went to a place called Thick as Thieves, which is come back to the conversation we had a while back about speakeasies, is definitely leaning into that style. There's a phone, but they don't make it too hard. You dial, they tell you what number to dial. Actually, one of the bartenders there, the funniest thing is they have a little camera above the bar because so much of their clientele doesn't actually know how to use a rotary phone. So often they see people like pull their phones out, like their smartphones out, and are like, YouTube tutorial, how to use a rotary phone, which fucking cracks me up because I my first phone as a kid was a rotary phone. So I'm that old. I went in, they were like ID, and I was like, look, I knew how to use the phone. Isn't that enough? And they were like, yeah, fair enough. So had a couple of great cocktails there. Actually, a kind of a pineapple drink. It was kind of with a pineapple, a special pineapple rum from Plantation or Plant Array or whatever they're calling themselves now. They're Stiggins. And then I have too many to name. We'll get into it, I'm sure, during the episode. But a great, great place to drink cocktails, which was super cool to see. So how about you?
Cool. Well, the past weekend, right, was Esty's first birthday. So we had some fun drinks. Had her birthday party, and we had, the 3 themed cocktails for her, the Zesty Esty, the Rock and Rose Martini, and the Cheeky Tiki, because she has cute cheeks. But the Cheeky Tiki was just a Mai Tai, but it was a Mai Tai made with this Mai Tai like syrup that you buy that Brian Miller told us about, and he was the bartender actually, that is called the Wiki Wiki Mai Tai mix.
Okay.
And let's just make sure it's the Wiki. Yeah. The Latitude 29 Wiki Wiki Mai Tai mix. And I'm telling y'all right now, it made a delicious Mai Tai, and then all you need is fresh lime juice and 2 ounces of rum. And people were coming up to us like, this is the most delicious Mai Tai we've ever had. And Ryan said it's like his secret weapon. He brings a bottle of it when he travels, and it comes in like a little like plastic bottle, and it has enough to make a bunch of different kinds of a bunch of Mai Tais. And y'all got to go buy this thing. I was really, really blown away by how good it was. And you can buy it from Latitude 29. They make a lot of other stuff too. They make Orgeat. I think they talked about Latitude 29's Orgeat on Cocktail College before, but it's they're a Brooklyn based company, and this thing was just incredible. And yeah, you got to go buy it. The other stuff we had, I got to finally go check out Theodora, which is a new restaurant in Brooklyn that is owned by the same chef that owns Miss Otta, which, as most people know, is one of my favorite restaurants. And this is a spot that's I don't want to say it's more fine dining because it's not, but it's a little bit fancier in terms of its concept. Really cool wine list. The entire wine list is basically focused on a bunch of producers that the beverage director Maggie loves. So she like has a lot of wines from all these different producers that she's gotten to know since running the program at Misada. And then she also has like, then she fills it out with other stuff as well. But I thought that was really cool. Great cocktail program. And then they do a bunch of dry aged fish,
ooh,
which was really cool. And I have not seen in New York yet. I had seen a few places doing it actually in DC, and I'm sure places do it in Seattle.
Oh yeah, I think so.
But like it's a really cool concept, right? Because it concentrates the flavors and you know, you're not dry aging the fish for like the amount of time you dry age meat, but it's a few days that they hang in this really cool fridge they have in the center of the restaurant you can see. And then it really makes the fish just like come out so much more moist and the skin super crispy and just really awesome. So really delicious food, and I highly recommend it. And we had a really just great bottle of Italian wine from Etna that Maggie had recommended. And then in Vegas, which we're going to talk about, Josh and I were there for the bar and restaurant convention and spoke. And the night before the conference, he and I went to everything there, if it's on the strip, right, is like a transplant from somewhere. And so this was Bovet's, which was the same people that own Au Cheval in Chicago. And I think there's a Bovet's in Chicago as well. And this was their steakhouse that happened to randomly be the restaurant that was in our hotel. We didn't realize that when we made a reservation, but also most stuff in Vegas is weirdly closed on Monday. So this was like our option. But the wine list was very American Napa Cab and then Bordeaux heavy. And I had Chateau d'Issan a long time ago. And so we had a nice bottle of Chateau d'Issan, which is a Left Bank classified growth that was really from Margaux that was really delicious. And those are probably the most memorable things I had, because we'll talk about more of them when we get into this. But I think you and I both had travels last week. So one of the things that I noticed in Vegas, and I was doing research afterwards, is just how much I actually think Vegas is more representative of America's tastes and preferences than, you know, where we live. So Vegas had its largest year for tourism last year, like 48 million people, I think, came through the city. It's clearly a destination. The hotels are quite often full. But what I noticed while going across the town for – we dined off-strip, we dined on-strip, et cetera, is a few themes. One, the dominant wines are still the wines that have been talked about in American wine culture for the last 30, 40 years. You see more American Cabernet, mostly from Napa, American Chardonnay, mostly from Napa, and Bordeaux and Burgundy and Super Tuscans than almost anything else on the lists,
yep.
Which is really, really interesting, even at restaurants that are not 100% like meat focused.
Yeah.
And I think that speaks to, you know, again, how much those wines have built themselves in the consciousness of American consumers that when you have money and you are spending, these are the wines you buy, right? No, it was very hard to find like not only affordable wines, but wines from obscure regions, et cetera, like very hard.
Yeah.
And the other thing that I noticed that was really interesting was how much most places, even the places that are considered to be great cocktail bars by other outlets, don't actually give a shit about cocktails. So at one bar that we went to that was affiliated with the Nomad Hotel, our gin martinis were shaken. At another bar, our Manhattan was shaken. The quality of ice at almost every bar was that of the ice that you get out of like an ice machine.
Yeah.
Only when we finally asked if they happened to have a large rock did the bartender say, oh yeah, we actually have cold draft, but most people have to ask for it. We don't just serve it normally, which was crazy to me. So I was wondering, is that a cost thing? Is that they just don't think most people give it? But what that really meant to me is like, I think they just know most people don't give a shit.
Yeah.
Right. And just shows you still how much when we talk about drinks in America and the fact that our consciousness about cocktails, et cetera, is growing, how much the majority of consumers' consciousness towards cocktails is still at a very, very base level, right? And what do I mean by that? I mean, I actually don't think that the bartenders shook the cocktails because they didn't know to stir them. I think they shook them because that's how generally those cocktails are ordered by the majority of their consumers. Because I think the majority of Americans still think that all cocktails are shaken. That's what a shaker's for, right? James Bond says shaken, not stirred, right? This is in the idea of the majority of American consumers. That's what you do. At these restaurants, I think the reason those wines are there is because these are the wines that the majority of American consumers think of still as the finest wines. You know what also was missing on a lot of these lists? Large sections of Merlot.
Yeah.
Right? Because the majority of American consumers still think that's a shit wine thanks to one movie.
20 years later.
Yeah. And I found Vegas fascinating for that regard, is that I think it's somewhat caught up to trends in a way because it's brought in all these great, you know, restaurant groups and brands, et cetera, from cities that are really driving, you know, food and dining and drinks culture, LA, New York, Chicago, the ones we talk about all the time, right?
Yeah.
But it's then adapting those brands and that service for the majority of the Americans.
Yeah.
For an American clientele that, like, this might be the only time they go to a restaurant like this year.
Yeah.
And they want what probably 80% of the American population wants, which is the big, bold wines that they're used to and basically a cocktail that is shaken or heavily diluted.
Yeah.
And the other thing that I found that was really interesting is that at one restaurant, I checked out the menu, they had a whole martini list. So they're on the trend of martinis, right?
Yeah.
Guess how many of the martinis were made with gin?
One.
Zero.
Wow.
Which, again, I think speaks to the fact that the majority of American drinkers still really drink vodka and think that the vodka martini is the martini, right? That's why and I think that, again, is why Grey Goose has a vodka martini out on the market, RTD, and, like, you don't see a lot of gin martinis from huge brands out on the market because the gin martini is still for really the gin drinker. And that drinker, that population of drinker has not really grown that much in mainstream America.
Well, and that population might not want an RTD gin martini.
Exactly.
They might want their gin martini made to order.
Exactly. And then they have their spec.
Yeah.
Right. So I don't know, man. I thought it would be fun to chat about this and your travels, just because I think it's really important for us as people that look at the industry and talk about it and cover it and write about it, all that stuff, to understand what the majority of American drinking culture really is still favoring. And I think one of the best places to do that is Vegas, because while I had not been to Vegas in a very long time, I think it is a big destination for a lot of America. It is a place to go to spend money, to feel successful, to eat big meals, to go out to fancy things. And you know, that same population of people may not necessarily think of New York as New York is a destination they will go to once.
Yeah.
Right. But Vegas, for a lot of people, is a place they go every year, every other year. And if you think about the amount of huge conferences, it's the largest, you know, convention center in the country. If you think about the amount of conferences that come through that city every single week from all over the country, these restaurants and bars are being built to cater to them and them alone, I think.
Yeah. Well, and I think it's also instructive that, in a way, you know, you've seen so much about Vegas's food scene over the last couple of decades, where they have really sought to bring in exciting or dynamic restaurateurs and concepts from all over the country. But it's true that many of those concepts don't themselves have super dynamic wine or beverage programs, or at least those don't seem as critical to the sort of idea of what it is to have a great restaurant in Las Vegas in the way that it might feel that way in some of their cities of origin. You know, I get a lot of press releases. I know you do too. And I always look at I usually look at the ones from Vegas, because I think in part what you're talking about, right? Like, what is it that we're trying to glean from this? And it's true that almost every one of those places launches with a very similar beverage program. Yes. You know, the very kind of classic And let's be clear too, high price point wines
yep.
from America and Europe. You know, you didn't mention champagne, but I think that's something that we're seeing a lot of.
Oh, there's too. A lot of champagne. Yeah, I did not mention that, but there is a lot. But all the big houses, I didn't see a lot of grower shit.
Yeah. And the whole, I mean, in a way, Vegas is a very well constructed machine to extract money from people's pockets and send them home, you know, hopefully satisfied, but a little lighter. And in a way, like, of course, they're going to gravitate towards wines that have, you know, high price tags, have cachet that people will slap down $500 or $1,000 or $10,000 a bottle on, because that what else, you're not going to carry stuff that people won't spend that on, because Vegas is a city to spend. It's a city to be conspicuous in your consumption. It's kind of America's, you know, it's America's sort of place of sin, right? And so people right. go do that. And that's true with gambling. It's true with sex. It's true with eating and drinking, all those things, right? And so in a way, none of this surprises me, except that I'm a little surprised to hear, although maybe I shouldn't be, that there isn't, and I'm sure there are craft cocktail bars in Vegas, you know, it has to exist because there is a clientele for that. But I am surprised that even if as the food in a lot of these places has, you know, maybe been a little more on trend, even if those trends can be varied, that it sounds like the drinks have not been, which, yeah, I guess maybe goes to show you that in a little bit, as we were talking about on Friday, what is a trend and how ephemeral is it? And does it actually have to have some broader kind of cultural resonance before it's fair to call it a trend? So I don't know.
I think, well, and I think that speaks to, again, just taste preferences. Like,
yeah,
the places that we went to that were cocktail bars are some of the places, and look, we didn't get to go to every place. We weren't there for that long. So again, yes, if you're a listener that lives in Vegas or you go to Vegas and maybe you have a spot, let us know that is different than what I'm explaining. But like the place we went to are all bars that have been on people's lists of the best bars in Vegas, the must visit bars in Vegas, etc. And almost all of them, there was always like a very sweet version of an old fashioned, yeah. right? Vanilla, elderflower, like some kind of flavoring or some kind of fat washing. There was almost never just really classic cocktails. Mm-hmm. There was always a margarita. Again, American taste preferences. And I think, again, that speaks to one of the biggest trends that we've seen in American drinking over the past few years, which is this desire for full flavor. Yep. And they're leaning into that as opposed to sort of what's happening in some of the other cities where like they're doing full flavor, but in a much bougier way. This is just straight up like, here's the syrup. We're dumping it in over your, you know, over a bunch of ice and like, here's that old fashioned and let it dilute. The only place I would say in Vegas that feels very authentic to one type of drinks era was one place I went to called Golden Tiki, which is a very famous tiki bar. And it's like a place that feels like it hasn't changed. Sure. And there they are making very accurate versions of classic tiki drinks, but it's off strip. Right, you have to take a car off strip to get there. It's in the same area where some of the best Asian restaurants in Vegas are, right? And so you really have to be seeking it to go yeah. there and really be in the know. And most people that are going to Vegas aren't going off strip.
Yeah.
And so, you know, for that place almost was there to cater to, I think, locals more and people that work in the industry there, et cetera, than it was to cater to the tourist who's coming from all over America, Canada, et cetera. And they're really at the big casinos and they want a very mass appeal experience.
Yeah.
So what about Boise then?
So I think the takeaways for me from Boise that were really interesting are one, something that I think we've talked about on the pod, I think it's come up a few times in various ways, is that there was a shocking to me amount of vibrancy in both the, you know, behind the scenes of the bars, you know, the people creating them, the people working in them. And also, you know, it seemed like a real appetite for these cocktail bars in particular. And one of the things that I asked everyone, I probably met talked with owners or bar managers at a half dozen cocktail bars over the course of my time there, which, you know, granted, Boise is not an enormous city. It doesn't have like dozens of craft cocktail bars, but you know, there are new ones opening kind of seemingly all the time. And everyone I talked to said that, you know, anywhere from like 60 to 90% of their sales were through their cocktail menus, which was really interesting to me. It was not what I expected. I, you know, and including some of the people there said, you know, it surprises them too, that they get relatively few call drinks, relatively few neat spirits. People who come into these places, which are, you know, admittedly cocktail bars, they're not the sort of, you know, more amorphous bar concepts that we, that you see too. Those people want the cocktails that are on the list. They want to explore them, and they're kind of there for the journey. And, you know, some of that is a lot of the audience for these are, you know, are locals, and Boise is growing really rapidly. It has a lot of people who are transplants from the West Coast, from other parts of the country, maybe places that have a longer standing or more, you know, kind of established cocktail scene, and they're there and they don't want to give any of that up, which totally, why would you? But also that, you know, these bars are making and coming up with really creative, interesting cocktails. You know, talked a lot about culinary cocktails with at a couple of places. Several of the places have really robust NA beverage programs, doing lots of really kind of dynamic things that I think absolutely rival what I've seen in Seattle and other places, and some really cool spaces too. And I think that's the other thing that is exciting to me about a place like Boise, and we've talked about, is for aspiring owners and bar managers and stuff like that, there is a lower barrier to entry in a place like Boise, right? It's cheaper to live there. It's cheaper to open a bar. There's a pretty good sized audience, and you know, it's a growing tourist destination. It's a growing business center in certain ways. You're in the state capital, so it's always going to bring in a certain amount of business just because people do business with state governments and stuff like that. And you have people who, but you know, getting a bar off the ground in a place like that is not only less expensive, but there's also a longer runway. And that's the thing I've been thinking about a lot when it comes to the cocktail bar industry in particular, of and it's true for restaurants and things like that in the biggest cities, is you have so little leeway as a place to kind of figure yourself out, to figure out your aesthetic, to figure out your vibe, to figure out your menu. If you don't kind of connect right away, you're not buzzy right away, you're not packed right away, you're probably not going to make it, because there's just so much cost and so much competition. And you know, I was surprised. I talked to a fair amount of bar staff while I was there too. And, you know, a lot of the people there are people who are either are from the Boise area or from Idaho more generally, and maybe have never really lived elsewhere, or they're people who are from the area, moved away and came back, and are really committed to trying to grow the industry there. And obviously there's challenges to that, right? Idaho has some pretty restrictive liquor laws. I was mentioning to Tim McCurdy when we were talking to him last week about how one of the most interesting things to me about it is, because of the liquor laws, you're not allowed to pre-batch anything that involves alcohol. You can't infuse anything. You really kind of can't do anything to the spirit besides mix it in a cocktail to order, which obviously hamstrings bars in certain ways. You know, there are ways in which they would love to be able to do some of that pre-batching and infusing and blending of spirits and stuff ahead of time. But to me, on the other side of it, it does mean that you are really getting what to my eyes is kind of like one of the appeals of going to a cocktail bar, which is the drink is made in front of you. You watch them assemble it in a way that has sort of been taken out of, has been sort of diminished in certain bars in the country, where so much of the preparation of the drink happens in the hours or days beforehand. And it's not that you can't enjoy those drinks. It's not that there can't be other things about the bar that recommend it. But I do love seeing someone have to really build the cocktail in front of me. It's to me part of the deal of going to a cocktail bar is the show. And without that, I'm not sure quite what I'm getting. So Boise and Idaho in general, you kind of have to give them that because there's no other way to make drinks. But it also forces them to get really creative with kind of the kinds of drinks they make and establishing other ways to kind of make service more, faster or more efficient. I saw some really interesting well designs, not that anyone really cares, but like, you know, some well laid out, concepts and stuff like that.
Right, this is well designed.
Yeah, that's right. I was just like, well, look at that. And I think the last thing that was really a takeaway to me that was really interesting was, and it's not surprising to hear, but at least for the time being, there's also a real camaraderie and sense of, you know, kind of trying to build a cocktail scene together, which, you know, look, were people putting on a good face for me, the writer? Sure, maybe, I don't know. But also, I think it's true that there's still, you know, the scene is pretty nascent. You know, no one is super established. And I think they see a real benefit in, you know, another bar opening that's doing, that's making quality cocktails, that's maybe bringing in clientele, that's getting some attention, things like that. Because everyone was super eager to tell me a bunch of other places to try. And it was a lot of like, oh, have you been here yet? Have you been there yet? Have you tried this? You got to go there. Like, you know, that was cool. You know, that's a nice energy to have. And I hope it maintains.
Yeah, I love that. I mean, I think these are two really good examples of what we see happening across the country in drinks, right? In the sort of bigger, small cities, right? So the Boise's, the Birmingham's, I didn't mean to do two B's, but you know what I mean? There are Louisville, et cetera. There are craft cocktail scenes that are growing that are, you know, taking their inspiration from San Francisco, New York, LA, et cetera. And then in Vegas, you basically have a city that is trying to be everything to everyone, which means basically just playing the hits on a mass scale.
Yeah.
You know, and saying, look, we're here, as you said, to just extract money from someone who's only here for usually a few days. And what that means is having basically what 80% of the country still really enjoys. And for everyone else, like, they'll find something.
Yeah.
And I found that to be true for Josh and I. And we went out with our friend Dave, who owns Lalu, like here in Brooklyn. We found a wine on you know, the wine list when we went out to dinner that we enjoyed. We really enjoyed. But like, we found one and that was enough for us. And they probably figure most people are gonna find who need that are gonna find that one wine. Sure. And for everyone else, there was 30 Cabernets.
Yeah. Well, and I think, you know, it's interesting because I think this came into more clarity for me is like, you know, Vegas is such a catch-all for everything, right? It's trying to be everything to everyone. And in the same way that we would look at an individual restaurant or a bar, a little bit like, well, don't you have a point here, right? Like, isn't there some kind of focus? Without that, you kind of end up with a menu that, as you said, plays the hits. And look, Vegas is like famous for, you know, it's seen as this great entertainment city, but like, what is Vegas doing now? It's a bunch of these permanent installations of artists that were at their heyday 20 years ago. And it's like, you know, ever since Elvis, the idea of a Vegas residency has been a thing. But it's like, what exactly are we trading on here? Nostalgia, established hits? Like, it's fine. It works. It's obviously very successful, but I don't know that it's inherently like, it's instructive for you and me because it's instructive to look at what the American drinking public is interested in or wants or seems to think it wants. But it's also interesting because it pushes no boundaries, and that's whatever. It's fine.
Yep, totally. This has been fun. Let us know what you think. Hit us up at podcast@vinepair.com. Love to hear your thoughts on Vegas.
Mid-sized cities that start with B that have great drinks culture that we
should let us know that too. Let us know that too. And I will see you back here on Friday, Zach.
Sounds great.
Thanks so much for listening to the Vine Pair Podcast, the flagship podcast of the Vine Pair Podcast Network. If you love listening to this show, or even if you don't, but I really hope that you do, as much as we really do love making it, then please drop us a review or a rating wherever it is that you get your podcast, whether that be iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, anywhere. If you are listening to this on a device right now through an app, however you got this audio, please drop a review. It really helps everyone else discover the show. And now for some totally awesome credits. So, the Vine Pair Podcast is recorded in our New York City headquarters and in Seattle, Washington, in Zach Chabal's basement. It is recorded by Zach, mastered and produced by Zach. He loves all the credit. Keep giving it to him. Drop his name in the reviews. He's going to love hearing how much you love him. It is also recorded in New York City by our tastings director, Keith Beavers, who is the managing director of the entire Vine Pair Podcast Network. I'd also love to give a shout out to our editor-in-chief, Joanna Sherino, who joins us on every single podcast as our third and most important host. Thank you as well to the entire Vine Pair staff and everyone who's been involved in making Vine Pair as special as it's become. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next week.